You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The social and political tensions that led to the Opium Wars are brought vividly to life in Amitav Ghosh's latest novel, Sea of Poppies. The book, which is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, is being compared to everything from Moby Dick to Star Wars, and it was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize. I'm pleased that it has brought Mr. Ghosh back to the show today. So it's a pleasure to see you.
A pleasure to see you, Leonard, and thank you for having me.
This novel begins in 1838 and concerns the voyages of a former slave ship called the Ibis, which is brought to Calcutta to be converted to the opium trade. Isn't this the most historical of all of your novels? I mean, you've written about the past, but nothing this far into the past.
Yes, that's absolutely true. This certainly goes back to the early 19th century, and my last historical novel was set in the late 19th century onwards, yes.
Were there any contemporary reasons that led you to want to write about this period, the lead up to the Opium Wars?
Well, I actually started writing this as a book about migration from India, you know, the great movement of indentured workers that started in the 19th century. I've been fascinated by that for a very long time, and my book, The Glass Palace, is also partly about that. But the migration.
And then there was the other great migration after the partition of India into Pakistan and India.
Yes.
There's been a lot of migration in the Indian subcontinent.
Yes, but that was really a redistribution of population within the subcontinent. This was a migration out across the sea. This movement really started in the 1830s. And, it was while I was sort of looking into the background of that that I came to see how closely that was connected with the opium trade.
You have a PhD in social anthropology from Oxford. How does your academic training affect your approach when you're researching a novel like this?
I think it probably helps a lot, because certainly one thing that it did teach me is how to find my way around a library. So, I enjoy the research. I enjoy finding, odd kinds of material in odd places. But, in the end, writing a novel is so different from doing any kind of academic work. It's really about the characters. It's about living in your head. And, I don't think it helps there at all.
But it is interesting that you have this education in England, and yet the British really are awful in this story, aren't they? This is a war that was fought by the British for the right to export opium from India to China.
Yes, it was really a war that they fought in order to force opium upon China. And, what can you say? I mean, there were many, Britain, like every other country, produces lots of very different kinds of people. But the people who are generally slave traders and opium traders tend not to be the most likable members of the population.
But this wasn't just private entrepreneurs. This was government policy. How much of this was a matter of making lots of money, and how much the result of British political foreign policy goals?
A lot of it was just about making money. You see, the East India Company declared a monopoly in the opium trade in eastern India, going back to the late 18th century. And really, it was the opium trade that financed the British colonial regime in India. So they really needed to export opium to China.
And only China? Were they exporting it elsewhere?
Yes, they were exporting it elsewhere too, to Indonesia, the East Indies, as they were called then. They were big consumers, too.
As long as it was Asians and not Europeans who were going to be addicted to the opium.
Yes, but a very large number of the Europeans who were in Asia were actually taking opium. And actually, opium wasn't banned in England either. I mean, Queen Victoria took opium in the form of laudanum. In fact, in the 19th century, people in all around the world took a fair amount of opium, yeah.
Were you aware of this bit of colonial history when you were growing up in Calcutta?
Not at all. Not only was I not aware of it then, I mean, even afterwards, I did, my undergraduate degree was in history. We were just not taught about this. And really, opium was so important in colonial India. It was absolutely the foundation of the economy. It formed a fifth of their revenues. So it's one aspect of that history which has been completely silenced and blanked out.
By the British themselves, because it's so embarrassing?
I think it's partly by the British, but I think it's just as much by Indians, it so happens that one of the few Indian historians who does actually write about the opium trade is an old friend of mine. And I was talking to him about it, and he says he can't get his students to look into this because they're kind of, I guess there's an anxiety or an embarrassment.
Your cast of characters range widely. You have an English ship owner, an American ship's mate. You have Lascar sailors, a French woman, Bengalis of various castes, all brought together by this ship. Would there have been so many different kinds of people in Calcutta at that time?
Absolutely. Calcutta was an incredibly sort of varied place in those days. You know, if you, for example, look at Melville's book, Redburn, you know, which is about his, it has nothing to do with India or Asia. But in the first 10 pages, he mentions Calcutta like a dozen times. You know, especially in the age of sail, people were traveling to these places all the time. And because of the opium exports, Calcutta was a very important part of the world network of, you know, ports.
Although your story opens 500 miles west of Calcutta with a poppy farmer.
Yes, yes. The central character in the book is, in fact, a woman whose name is Diti. She's she's growing poppies on this farm, and it becomes, she can't sustain the enterprise, and her husband dies, so she runs away with a man from this village, and then they find their way onto the ship.
Now she runs away. Wouldn't she have been expected to throw herself on her husband's funeral pyre?
Expected maybe, yes, in her case, certainly her whole family was pressuring her towards that. So she is actually rescued by this man who takes her away.
Would that have made her something of a pariah because she broke with tradition?
Oh, an absolute pariah. I mean, she could never have gone back to that village. In the first place, she's a widow who's run away with another man. The man is from a different caste. And, you know, she would have been hounded.
Well, how much of that was really just practical because it avoids the whole issue of supporting the widow?
I don't think it was ever a question of practicality. This custom was something that had once occurred, and then suddenly in the late 18th and early 19th century, especially, I suppose, under the trauma of invasion and colonialism and so on, it suddenly sort of increased, you know. I mean, I think that often happens in sort of traumatized societies.
My guest is Amitav Ghosh. His latest book, a novel called Sea of Poppies, which is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. The first of three books. This is the lead up to the Opium Wars. So you're going to follow this through to the end of the Opium Wars?
I'm going to follow this wherever it goes, you know.
You don't know what the other books are going to be?
No, by no means. I mean, when I started writing this book, I was kind of a year into it, and I realized I just liked these characters so much. I just wanted to be able to follow them for a very, very long time.
Was Diti there from the start?
She was. She was one of the characters. She wasn't there absolutely at the start as she now is. But, you know, Diti really became, for me, the center of the book. She claimed that place for herself. You know, she became the book's mainsail, really.
I've always wondered how that works, how a novelist starts writing a book with a different idea and then a character takes over and the author falls in love with something that just came out of his own or her own imagination.
Yes, it's a very mysterious process, and I don't even really know. I mean, I certainly can't explain how it happens, but in this book, I must say that all the characters really, I mean, completely captivated me, all of them in different ways. And I found them also very much fun to be with, you know. They were very entertaining, and I think that really comes from the historical circumstance.
Well, the Ibis would be
yes.
Was originally a slave ship brought from Baltimore to Calcutta to be used for the opium trade, but then the owner decides to change plans again to transport coolies and convicts. Is that something that really happened?
Oh yes, yes. In the early 19th century, many former slaving ships were actually taken to the Indian Ocean and converted to the opium trade and to the coolie trade. Yes, that's actually historically accurate.
The language spoken on the ship is a strange kind of pidgin, a mix of English, Hindi, and what else?
Oh, lots of different languages. You know, nautical speech has always been incredibly international and has always drawn in lots of different kinds of influences. I mean, you'll remember in Moby Dick in the 40th chapter, there's this wonderful section where, you know, everybody's singing in different languages, and you suddenly realize that this little Nantucket whaling ship is actually populated by a kind of floating United Nations.
So when people have compared this to Moby Dick, were they catching on to something? Was Moby Dick one of the books that was in the back of your head when you were writing it?
Well, look, I mean, Melville is my great hero. I really, he's been an inspiration to me, not just Moby Dick, but also many of the other books, the ethnological books, the ecological books. I mean, I think he's just an endlessly fecund writer. But anyone who writes with Moby Dick in the back of their head is just inviting disaster.
You're because, in trouble. You know. Well, you have this odd language I mentioned. Is this really the way people spoke, or did you make some of this up?
Look, you know, we don't know how people spoke in those days. But especially, we do know that that English people who'd grown up in India were profoundly influenced by Indian languages, you know. We know that when they went back to England, people often couldn't understand them. Say, someone like Rudyard Kipling, he couldn't speak English for the first 4 years of his life, you know. They were brought up, after all, by Indian, you know, servants often. So they were deeply sort of influenced by Indian languages. And if you look at, say, the 19th century English vocabulary, it's actually very much more influenced by Asian languages than today's English.
In fact, now the influence goes the other way, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's a curious paradox of globalization that people think that, you know, the English language has opened up. In fact, if anything, it's closed down. It's grown narrower and narrower in the 20th century.
Although Salman Rushdie thinks that it's the former British colonies, the writing in English, that has enriched English fiction, English language fiction in recent years.
That's certainly been the case. But, I mean, if you take the vocabulary of, say, 19th century English, it's very, very much more varied than the English vocabulary of today.
Well, would you have grown up speaking English or Bengali? Because there's a great Bengali tradition, literary tradition.
Absolutely. But like most educated Bengalis, I would have known both. You know, Bengal's great talent is that we served as like translators, you know. So even the earliest Bengali magazines were bilingual. They were published in English and in Bengali.
You include a kind of glossary called a crestomathy. I never saw that word before.
Yes, it's a wonderful 19th century word. It just means a guide to language, you know. But it came to mean also, say, like glossaries and grammars and so on. And the crestomathy for this book is actually written by one of the characters in the book who's very much interested in the language.
So. And could you were going to read it just a little bit for us, give us a taste
sure.
of what this language is all about?
Sure. This is one of the English characters speaking, and he's describing a dinner party thrown by the Maharaja of by the Raja of Raskhali, whom he calls the Rascally Roger. one thing I should say before I start reading this is that many of the words here will seem unfamiliar to you, but in fact they're English. They're in the Oxford English Dictionary. You know?
And we can figure them out in
yes,
context if we don't,
sure.
even if we don't look at the, how did you say it, crestomathy?
Crestomathy, yes. In the old days, the rascally Babaji Khana was the best in the city. No fear of pish-pash and cobbly-mash at the rascally table. Oh, no. The dumpooks and pulaus were good enough, but we old hands, we'd wait for the curry of cock-up and the chichki of pollock-sog. Oh, he set a rankin' table, I can tell you. And mind you, supper was just the start. The real tamasha came later in the Nauch Khana. Now there was another chakmak sight for you. Rows of kursis for the sahibs and mems to sit on, sitringis and takias for the natives, the babus puffing at their hubble bubbles and the sahibs lighting their Sumatra bunkuses, kanchanis whirling and tikitaw boys beating their tablas. Oh, that old lucha knew how to put on a Nauch all right. He was a sly little shaitan too, the rascally Raja.
Amitav Ghosh reading from his latest novel called Sea of Poppies, which is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Reviews have been describing this novel as cinematic. Are there any plans to film it?
Well, it's interesting that you mention that. A few directors have actually been in touch with me. You know, whether these things work out or not, one never knows.
Well, thank you so much for coming by to talk about it, and I look forward to talking about the other two books in this trilogy. Are there going to be other books in between, or is this your project for the next however many years?
This is my project for the next 10, 15, 20 years. I don't know.
Well, let's hope it's quicker than that.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Leonard. Thank you for having me.